The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Delivering an eviscerating, raw honesty, writer's writer Danny Shapiro is the best-selling author of four previous memoirs and five novels, including Black and White and Family History. Her books span diverse subjects, from her tumultuous upbringing in an Orthodox Jewish community and the tragic death of her father, to her explorations of spirituality and the nature of our deepest relationships. Inheritance, her 10th book and 5th memoir, charts the staggering implications of a genetic test taken out of idle curiosity. Origin stories are among the most powerful that exist because they shape people's identities and anchor them to a culture, a place, and other people. What makes us who we are? What combination of memory, history, biology, experience, and soul defines us? When stories about the past change, so does the future. Tonight, she'll be joined in conversation with Beth Kephart, a professor of creative nonfiction and memoir at the University of Pennsylvania and the award-winning author of 24 books. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Danny Shapiro and Beth Kephart to the Free Library.
Hello, Philadelphia. We are so happy to have you here, and we are so happy to have you here.
And I am so happy to be with you, and to be with you.
My questions are a series of an opportunity for you to reflect on the book as I experienced it. And Danny's going to actually read from the book a few questions in, so you get to hear her voice. And I'm going to begin, Danny, with this question. You had a powerful, nearly romantic sense of your family and its past, you write in the book. And some of that had to do with your deep empathy for your father, some with the cultural and religious traditions passed down and down and down, some with the photographs and documents that physically frame your home. How do you think that sensibility gets instilled or becomes ingrained, and how has that sense shaped both your life and this book?
Well, one of the things that I've become so conscious of in the last few years, I think I was always conscious of it, but this experience has deepened that consciousness, is that our sense of identity is formed by the stories that we're told from the beginning, from the earliest of ages. And these were the stories that I was told. I come from a family on my father's side that was conscious of its place in the world in some way, of its posterity. It was kind of aware of its magic and of its majesty. And I still love, in a way, being part of that story. And so that became the way that I understood the world. Okay. And so, you know, there was a review that came out in the last week since the book came out, in which a critic said, Danny Shapiro is both the best person and the worst person for this to have happened to.
Yeah, I read that review.
Yeah. And that kind of, I mean, that just pretty much summed it up for me, because in the worst person department, my sense of identity was so ingrained in being from that family.
And your son's sense of family has also been ingrained in the stories that have been passed down.
Well, I tried for that to be true. I mean, that's actually interesting, because I don't know how true that is. Another thing that I've learned, I think, is that ancestors are stories that we tell ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when I actually had to sit my son down and say to him, I've discovered that my father wasn't my biological father, and that means that he wasn't your grandfather. I was worried that that would be destabilizing for him in some way, because it was destabilizing for me. Yeah. But I very quickly realized that it wasn't, because...
He had the greatest response. Tell them what it was.
Oh, well, I mean, part of his response was my dad was bald, and his dad was bald. I mean, they were really, and they looked exactly alike, and they were both bald. And I hadn't realized that my son was somehow aware that baldness is passed down through the mother's, father's, if that's even true, but I think it's something that he certainly believed. And so when, you know, after the concern for me and, you know, a little bit of a conversation about what was going on, he was like, so does this mean I'm not going to be bald?
And which is so perfect.
It was fantastic. Yeah. It was like the first time I could actually really laugh.
I mean, Danny had made this perfect dinner, his favorite dinner. She's preparing to tell him, and he's like, okay, but can I just mention this has been bothering me?
But you know, one of the things that I thought about in regard to that conversation is that I had tried very hard to... My dad died when I was 23, and I wanted my son to feel like my dad was part of his life, because it was important to me. And I'm an only child, he's an only child. So I wanted to imbue that sense of groundedness in this family, which is something that I had felt. But for him, ultimately, my father was an abstraction. He wore his tallis at his bar mitzvah. He wore his yarmulke. I talked about him. I showed him pictures. I showed him a film, even. There was a documentary film that my father's family, my grandfather and great-grandfather went back to the ancestral village in Poland in pre, you know, 1931. They went back, and there's actually footage of them praying and saying Kaddish at the foot of my great-great-grandfather's grave. And I would show it to my son and say, this is where your great-great-great-grandfather is buried, and not many people get to ever see that, not many Jews. And I tried to make it be meaningful, but actually it was an abstraction for him, which I understand perfectly now.
Well, shortly after you learned through the Ancestry.com results that your dad is not your biological father, you enter a period of physical trauma and shock. Quote, my body felt strange and weightless. Was I even here? Maybe I didn't exist. My whole life had been a dream I dreamed of. End quote. That trauma, Danny, continues to shadow you as the year unfolds. Every time you tell the story, every time you think of it, every time you plunge into greater research about the ethos of artificial insemination of that time, the disorientation is real, it is permeating. Again, from your book, the thick sludge was everywhere. I now understood it as shock. The sense of my own body as foreign, delicate, fractured, and the world at once hostile and implacable in its anonymity. You were writing this book as you were living this story. How did the trauma you were experiencing shape the sound of the words that you chose, shape the sentences you wrote, and shape the memoir's frame?
I love that question. I learned, you know, this is my 10th book. I've written a book about writing. My book's still writing. I've taught writing for 30 years.
Except that you're only 25, so that's a little bit of a lie.
And I learned something that I hadn't known, or that I thought that I was the exception to. I mean, we do that too, in the process of writing this book. So I began from pretty much the moment, there were 36 hours that elapsed between the time that I discovered that my father wasn't my biological father and the moment where I actually found out who my biological father was. 36 hours, which was
crazy.
Yeah. Bonkers. And in that period of time, just immediately after all of this discovery, my husband and I were in San Francisco, and next door to our hotel was we were in Japantown, and there was this great stationery store, you know, huge paper notebooks, and I went and I bought index cards. It couldn't be a notebook. It couldn't be anything that even resembled something that prose would be written in. It was index cards, and I started scribbling down my thoughts, my feelings, my just words on these cards, which wasn't a new process for me, but it meant something different, I think. And I understood very, very quickly that I was going to write a book about this because I'm a writer, and it's the only way that one of my favorite quotes is from Joan Didion from Why I Write. You know, if I had even the remotest access to my own conscious mind, I never would have become a writer. So in order to be able to begin to sort out and figure out what it was that I was feeling, I needed to find language for it. And I mean, I spoke to my editor really early on, and it's like, it was obvious that this was going to be a book. But the sense that I could actually embark on writing a book, well, I thought, well, my last book, Hourglass, which is a memoir about marriage, my marriage, was written very much from the present. Yeah. And I had sort of made a specialty of excavating life from the present moment. My memoir, Devotion, also does that, mm-hmm. like from the moment. So I thought, well, I can do that now again. So I began when I came home, and I started writing, and it was almost like I was writing from the breathless present of the story. Yeah. And I got about 200 pages into a manuscript, and then I had to put it on hold because I was going on book tour for that memoir, Hourglass, that I had just finished right before I made this discovery. And I was gone for a couple of months. I really put it aside. My life became this kind of split screen where I was out there promoting my new book, but this whole other reality had not even begun to settle in for me. And then I returned home, and I took myself to a cafe near my house where I like to read with those 200 pages, and I reread them, and my heart just sank. It wasn't it. I hadn't found it. There was something shapeless about it. And what I understood really quickly, and to go back to Didion, I had been thinking about the Year of Magical Thinking mm-hmm. a lot, not as a model, but as an inspiration in a way for being able to write about something traumatic. And in my mind, even though I had read the book a couple of times, I thought, well, she's writing from the center of it. So I reread The Year of Magical Thinking after my own work. I realized I was going to have to start over again. And I realized that she wasn't writing from the immediate present. She was writing from like the slightest narrative distance, just enough distance so that a fulcrum was kind of created so that she could move toward the moment of devastation of her husband's death and also away from it with a mm-hmm. cool remove that allowed her to mm-hmm. quote philosophers and, you know, and be kind of her journalistic mm-hmm. self. And I understood that. I understood that I was actually at a point, because I now had had that bit of a remove, yeah. where I could find a fulcrum. But I didn't know what it was yet. And I remember saying to my husband, who's also a writer, I know this is productive despair, but it just feels like despair. I would tell any writer, yeah, I understand you have to throw out these 200 pages, but it's going to be really great because it's going to be okay. You're just going to start over. And but I didn't, I mean, when it happens to you, you just feel like, not, it's just awful, awful. And then there was a moment, so I walked around and walked into walls for a while, and then there was a moment where I remembered, I kept on thinking of this moment right after I laid eyes on my biological father for the first time, which happened in a hotel room in San Francisco on a YouTube video. And I remember afterwards getting up and walking into the bathroom and looking at my face in the mirror, and for the first time seeing my face, for the first time understanding my face. And I had kept on thinking about that as a moment of where I wanted to begin the book, but that didn't feel quite right. And then I remembered a feeling. It was of being a child, mm-hmm. being a little girl, and how I used to all the time play a game almost in which I was staring at myself in the mirror. And it wasn't like vanity, and it was really a feeling of watching my face until it began to morph and change and look true to me. And then I thought, that's it, I have it, I have my fulcrum, and I have the place from which I can tell the story. And then it really became about telling the story. Mm. So for the first two-thirds of the book, I was telling a story that I had already lived and I had already been through. I was actually emotionally in the part of the book that's the final part, where I was deep into the reading and the philosophy and
the research,
which was piling up all around me and which I couldn't wait to dig into and write about, but I had to actually, in a disciplined way, tell the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Didion brings that clinical distance in the beginning, and your beginning is a very interesting beginning, and I thought a lot about that, and I appreciate hearing where that came from. And also, no 200 pages are ever wasted. They're essential to the process.
Yeah.
And perhaps they helped shape what the tone and voice would not be.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about what the voice in those 200 pages were, and why you wanted to shed them?
So what I came to understand is that in the books that I had written that did come from kind of writing from the present moment was not traumatic. My marriage wasn't traumatic. I was trying to explore something.
But there
about
was
marriage.
That woodpecker, you know, that was traumatic.
Yeah, but somehow he didn't create trauma. He just created damage. And then in devotion, it was a spiritual crisis in a way, but it wasn't traumatic. What I realized was that I was writing directly from the center of the trauma, and that you can't do that. That writing from the center of a traumatic experience does not allow a narrative to be created. In the book, at one point, I quote the great Bessel van der Kolk. Some of you may know his work. He wrote a great book called The Body Keeps the Score. He's a psychologist. He writes about trauma, studied trauma. And he writes, it is the nature of trauma that it does not allow a story to be told. So I think poets can write directly from trauma. I think that that's why they're poets and a little mad.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I really have thought a lot about this.
Yeah.
And the distillation of trauma into language is something that can happen and something that poets can do. But to turn it into prose, I think it goes back to my buying those index cards. I was in a fractured, fragmented place. And it's also the nature of trauma that when you tell, so anyone who's been through a traumatic experience of any kind, you just want to tell the story over and over and over and over and over again. It's the thing that makes the story real to you. I was doing that on the page in those first 200 pages. So when I would ask a question, it would come back to the same place because it didn't deepen, the question didn't become different, my understanding of it hadn't changed until I was able to take that step back and think about what it was to make art out of it, what it was to make literature out of it, and think about and it was a book unlike any of my other books where I actually had to think, what are the universal themes here? Because the details are bonkers. So what is going to make any reader want to pick up this book? I mean, in my other memoirs, I had a sick baby. Anyone can connect with a sick baby. I had a father who died in a car accident. Anyone can connect with that, whether it's happened to them or not. But how about, you know, I just found out that my father, my beloved father, who I believed was my father biologically for 54 years, wasn't my father, and it turns out that there was this anonymous sperm donor that was my father, and I never knew it. Not so much. Like, the immediate sense of compassion or understanding or like, oh my God, I can imagine just what that would be like. So I needed to find a way for the reader to imagine what that would be like, and I've never had to do that. So actually having that consciousness, which you also can't have from the center of a traumatic place.
I often think about and teach this notion of the guiding universal question, and so your reflection here is making me wonder, was there this centrifugal question that when you got lost as you were drafting, you came back to, and this is the pinned question that lies at the heart of this? And how would you phrase that question?
Yeah, I mean, because it was there in the first draft too, which was, what did my mother know? What did my father know?
Okay.
Again and again, what did my mother know? What did my father know?
Right. and you can't find out, which is so frustrating.
Right. I feel that I was able to get as close as humanly possible, but I would not, but I could never know for sure.
That's right.
And so learning, I mean, to, like, the narrative in a way is also partly about learning to live with and become comfortable with profound uncertainty. Not try to tie it up in a narrative bow and say, like, now I'm sure, which is interesting after a lifetime of being sure about something as basic as paternity.
My
birth certificate was a false document. The document of identity that we can all count on, it wasn't true. So when that happens, how do you, in a way, I found myself having to become willing kind of to be fluid, like to dance with it, to swim with it, but to never entirely, I can never say, and I'll never be able to say till my dying day, I absolutely know this.
This has nothing to do, it seems, but the thought, you have a tattoo now, and there's a certainty, right? Your body is marked in a certain, that is something you could control. I love that, and it's also what it is. Let me continue here, because I want to make sure that we get to your opportunity to read my favorite pages. I'm going to skip this question because you've just gone through a little bit. So the next one, you've mentioned the research that you did for this book, and it is genuinely fascinating. You encounter terms like mixed sperm treatment, biodad, as well as cultures of anonymity. What are the most interesting things you learned along the way about the donor process and the culture of that era, and that doctor on the University of Pennsylvania campus, who wasn't really, as it turned out, an accredited doctor. And I note in your acknowledgments that you had some research assistants. So what were you searching for? What were you desperate to find out from a scientific perspective, and what shocked and amazed and even perhaps in some way gratified you?
I just wanted to get as close as I possibly could, to sort of paraphrase Hamilton, to the room where it happened, you know, to the sense of what actually went on, which brings me back to the question, what did my mother know, what did my father know? And so, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting for me to be in Philadelphia, because I texted my husband from the train this afternoon saying, I'm almost in Philly, the place of my conception.
I wondered if you were going to go touch a building over there.
As I was kind of being driven through town, I was definitely having the, these are the streets that my parents walked. There's so many things that are really fascinating about it. But among them, this was a time in which infertility was so traumatic and shameful. Couples who weren't able to have children desperately wanted to either, hide it, find some way to make that not be true. And so my parents made their way to Philadelphia, something that still puzzles me in a way, because there were places in New York City that that did donor insemination, and my parents would have been much closer to New York. My father worked in New York. They were from New York. That may be part of why they came to Philadelphia. It also may have been that, so the scientist that Beth is referring to was named Dr. Edmund Farris, and I write about him quite a bit in the book. He was in fact a scientist, not an MD. So he was in fact, I later understood with a shock, practicing medicine without a license. He had been, some of you may know, anyone involved with Penn at all would know, the Wister Institute. Mm-hmm. He had been the head of the Wister Institute. Mm-hmm. So the Wister Institute had a colony of albino white rats at its disposal. This was kind of what they were known for and where a lot of their experiments happened. And Edmund Farris used the white rats to truly pioneer, although he never got credit for it, the LH test, the test that shows exactly where a woman is in her ovulation cycle. He never got credit for it because he was discredited. So a woman's a woman who's in wherever she was in her cycles, urine would be injected into the albino white rats, and then the rat would be, as an elderly endocrinologist told me later, sacrificed, and they would see, just being able to see the rat's ovaries where the woman was in her cycle. So this was what was going on. I think my mother was pointed to Edmund Farris because he actually, for all of his renegade Wild West stuff, was actually getting the job done. He was getting women pregnant. My parents would have been, I'm pretty sure of this, what I'm narrating now, they would have been brought to this, they would have gone to the Institute, they would have discussed certain practicalities like blood type, and religion, although that usually went right out the window really quickly. They would say, we'll try to get a Jewish donor, or we'll try to get a Catholic donor, or whatever. And that, in my just research, that would be the first thing to go. But matched physical characteristics of the father. So this was discussed. The parents would sign a piece of paper, and then great pains were taken to then have them forget that that ever happened. So the first thing that would happen is that they would be told it's a treatment, very gentle, non-medical word. It's a treatment that will help boost your chances of having your own child. They would be told, have sex, come in and do the procedure, go home and have sex again. That way you'll never really know. Whether they were told it or not, what often happened is that the sperm was mixed, the intended father and a donor, again, so that there would be just this question about paternity. And I believe that it was done with good intentions. I mean, we can all sit here now and go, that's really messed up. But we're understanding that from a presentist place of what we understand psychologically and emotionally about that. Also, they would be told the child will never know. The donors would be told no one will ever know. I mean, you can do this, it's in the name of science, and you're going to make $25 or whatever, and then many men who donated at that time never thought of it ever again, no matter how thoughtful they were. Yeah. But the idea of the child will never know is the most insidious part, because what we don't know, I was formed by what I didn't know. I spent my life not understanding what I didn't know, but knowing that there was something that I didn't know, a sense of not fitting in, a sense of otherness, a feeling that something wasn't quite right. Absolutely aware, and it's through my work. I mean, what's really interesting to me is that this is my 10th book, so I have 9 books that are like a trail of breadcrumbs where I can look back at my first novel that I wrote when I was 26 years old and see, oh, I knew. I knew it without being able to think it, because thinking it was like touching a live wire, but I knew.
And there were moments with the Kushner family, et cetera, that sort of, and Mark Strand and others. But I want to follow up on that too. It's not, and it's of course a very large thing, only about what you know and feel. It has real medical consequences. Your son faced a medical trauma, and you are being asked questions by the doctors, and you're saying, no one in our family has ever had this kind of seizure. And so that is also part of the great complexity of this for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was the certainty. You know, I've had this conversation a bunch with adoptive parents who may not know, for example, the paternity of, because birth mothers often choose not to or don't know the paternity to reveal it, and that's absolutely their right. And so I've had adoptive parents say to me, so essentially, what are you saying? Are you saying that the fact that my, you know, adoptive children don't know their paternity, that's going to be damaged? And the conversation is, no. Do your kids know they're adopted? Yes. Do they know that they don't know that? Yes. Well, that's a completely different story. Mm-hmm. My story was one in which I was certain of the medical history I was giving. My whole life I gave 50% incorrect medical history when I would go to doctors. I was carrying around largely all sorts of burdens medically that weren't mine to carry. So that was not, it was, you know, a little complicated, but when my son was sick as a baby, the certainty in which I said, there are no issues there, we have no family history of this.
Yeah,
and that continues to this day. I mean, I wrote a piece in Time magazine that came out a couple weeks ago, which was my one polemical piece about this, that largely has to do with the disclosure and the necessity of disclosure. And in it, I wrote, and it's interesting because it's creating, among other things, a bit of a reckoning where there are these parents who are older and are suddenly thinking, we're not going to get out of this without telling our, we're going to have to tell our grown children that we never told them this because otherwise they're going to find out. And what I wrote in the piece was, it doesn't matter whether you think it's right or you think it's wrong, it just is what it is. We are at a point now where there can't be these kinds of secrets anymore. I happen to think that's a really good thing. It's a very painful and complicated thing right now because there are so many people who are still wrapped up in that place.
And of course, you are also, you know of a half-sister, you don't know whether there are others. And so this is part of what you're learning, too. Here's a chance where you get to read. Among the things you search for as you are plunged unwittingly into this journey is a way of knowing what your parents actually knew. That gets to your questions about the treatment that awarded them, their only child, what your father knew, what your mother knew, what they knew together. You keep putting the pieces together, then learning something new. Ultimately, what you come to understand, your only certainty, is what the heart is capable of accepting. My favorite part of the book is your conversation with your aunt, and I'd love for you to read that part for us now.
So this is a moment with my father's younger sister, who at this point is 93 and a half years old. Now she's 95 years old.
And still very bright and sharp and wonderful.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. I talked to her the other day. I sent her one of the very first copies of this book that arrived for me, and she called me and she said that when she opened the book, just kind of cracked it open, it opened right to the chapter that was about her. Right. So I want to preface this just by saying I felt that I had to go see her and talk to her about this. Partly, I'm very close to her. Initially, I thought, I'm never going to tell her. It's going to break her heart. I'm just not going to tell her. And then I thought, you know, get over yourself, Danny. She has like 60 great-grandchildren. You're one of a vast number of people that she loves. She will survive this, and maybe she knows something. Maybe my dad had spoken with her, which was not the case, because I don't think my parents ever spoke with anyone. You're not an accident of history, Danny, Shirley said. Her eyes were brimming. Not as far as I'm concerned, and not as far as the world is concerned. This isn't about the cold scientific facts. I have to tell you, in every way, and I'm not saying it to make you feel good, and I'm taking a chance saying it, because you'll think I'm making it up, but between you and Paul, there was paternity, ownership, kinship. She trained her whole 93-year-old self, every cell in her being, in the direction of consoling me. Every bit of energy. It was the purest manifestation of love I had ever experienced. Knowing what you know, you're more of a daughter to Paul than you can possibly imagine. You take something that isn't your own and you breathe life into it. You create it, and it becomes your creation. You are an agent to help my brother express the finest kind of love. Her hand rested on top of mine. It's rare that you get an opportunity in life to stand outside yourself. It's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, child, come sit next to me, and now look. Finding all this out is a door to discovering what a father really is. It isn't closure. You may not get to have that, but it is an opening to a whole new vista. For the first time since that evening in June when I'd stared uncomprehendingly into my computer screen, I felt a sense of peace. At least for the moment, the constant ache was gone. You have to judge things by the result, Shirley continued. And the result, in which you can exult, is that the very best was combined in you. Grace, brains, creativity, beauty. Whatever alien, mechanical, outside element was in the story, it was the story of a success. You have such a rich endowment. You have been so recompensed. You carry the heightened sensitivity, to be sure. You carry the pain, and you also carry the reward. Her voice, hoarse from speaking for hours, was a part of me. Her strong hands, her expressive forehead, her sweet smile, all a part of me because she had always been a part of me. I had been so afraid that blood would be all that mattered. Oh, how I had underestimated my remarkable aunt. My car was waiting at the curb. She had hardly paused all afternoon. Her eyes had never left mine. Words had coursed through her as if channeled from the very God she believed in, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She was telling me that she was still my aunt, that my father was still my father. My whole lost family encircled us as we sat in the fading light of her kitchen in Chicago. Sweetheart, this opens up a world of inclusiveness, and in the end, you have to include yourself. You aren't bleeding color. You're holding the light ones and the dark ones. They're all yours. Ultimately, in all this, Danny, the postscript is that it's really called love.
That's wonderful. I love that passage. In a way, this book is, of course, it comes from trauma, but you gain a new perspective on the man who raised you and the love that he gave to you, and now you also have a new man in your life, one who looks like you and he talks, who is extraordinarily successful, and with whom you almost didn't have a conversation in person, but then you did. It was sort of a, am I going to get to meet him or not? And that's a part of the story. But as you said on Facebook, there are no spoilers here, so I can say that you do meet him. And it's this wonderful, it's a New Jersey restaurant, right? And I want you to say exactly what happens when you first set eyes on each other, that moment. I don't want to use the words, you use them.
Yeah, so this was a meeting that happened after a pretty delicate dance back and forth. The refrain in my book of how old is too old for a surprise. You know, you're a 78-year-old retired physician, and one day you're just checking your email, minding your own business, and there's an email from a woman saying, I think I might be your biological daughter. That's a surprise. So when he did decide that he wanted to meet me, he lives in the Pacific Northwest, but he was traveling east with his wife of 50 years, and he and his wife and my husband and I met at this restaurant in New Jersey. The date he offered me basically one date that worked for them was Erev Yom Kippur, which you can't make this stuff up. I mean, when he offered me the date, I was like, I'm going to look at my calendar and it's going to be either Yom Kippur, Erev Yom Kippur, that's what's going to happen. I'm going to meet my Presbyterian biological father on Erev Yom Kippur in Teaneck, New Jersey, where half of the rabbis are my cousins. That's what's going to happen. Okay. So, but on that day, it was a meeting. Like, how do you prepare for a meeting with the person who is your biological father who you've never known? How do you prepare? I wonder how he prepared. There was actually an instant level of comfort, because I think we all realized that we actually liked each other, and so there was relief in that. It wasn't awkward. Yeah. But it also, I thought a lot about it both during and after lunch. We spent 4.5 hours together. It really was like Yom Kippur by the time we said goodbye. And I was very aware of the fact that he didn't feel like my father to me. But he felt incredibly familiar. He felt like the cloth that I was cut from. And I had not experienced that with my own father. And I hadn't known I hadn't experienced it with my own father, because you have to know that you're missing it to actually, be aware of that. But it was a tremendous familiarity. And it wasn't just physical. It was gestural. It was humor. It was, at one point later, his daughter and I have become friends. And she's my half-sister. And her husband at one point said to me, you have his laugh. And I said to my husband, are laughs nature or nurture? And my husband said to me, well, think about our son Jacob. Like, think about his laugh when he was a baby. It was like all his own. Laughs are actually nature. You know, that's not learned. When babies start laughing when, and smiling, so what does that mean? What is that? I don't know, but it was very familiar. And yet at the same time, the fact that he didn't, and how could he feel like my father to me? He hadn't raised me, made me, slowly, because some of the journey for me was when very early on, when a well-meaning person, right after my discovery, said to me, "Well, your father's still your father." I wanted to like punch a wall because I thought, I don't know what that means right now. A secret was kept from me for 54 years. My father was not my biological father. What is it? How am I ever going to integrate this? And by that time, which was a bit later, I was beginning to slowly start to understand what makes a father a father, and how much I was formed emotionally and psychologically by the father who raised me.
Yeah.
But then there also was this father who was, there. It was like staring at the sun. And it was very hard to look at.
The beautiful Laura has given me that very sly notification that we have just a few more. So I have one more question for you that I will ask, a short question. It's directly related to what you're talking about. It's just a little elongation of it. And that is, what does it mean to be a father's daughter?
When that piece in Time magazine came out, a photograph accompanied it. And it's a really, really joyful, buoyant picture, one I only recently discovered because we have boxes of slides in our basement, of my dad and me, and we're on the beach somewhere, and I'm on his lap, and I'm just, my whole body is kind of sunk into his body, and I'm laughing, and it's just this beautiful moment of, like, this loving moment. And I had this moment when the piece was published where I thought, wow. So my mother took that picture, probably, and there is my father with me. And if they could have, like, looked into a crystal ball and realize that that photograph was going to be in Time magazine someday with me sharing the story that they really took such tremendous pains to hide, I wonder how they would feel. And yet, I feel now that what my Aunt Shirley said was really true, that, I have tried my whole writing life to honor my father. That's kind of been my... it's been my engine as a writer. There's this beautiful interview of William Maxwell that accompanies an audio recording of his last novel. And in it, the interviewer says to him, your mother died when you're very young. If your mother were here right now, what would you say to her? And Maxwell says, I wrote all these books for you. And I feel like I wrote all those books for my father, and that this book is actually, when I started it, I didn't know if it was going to be a betrayal of him or an homage to him or a kaddish for him. And in the end, that's what it is.
Very much so. We have, 15, 20 minutes. I have new glasses, but that doesn't mean I necessarily can see as well as I should be able to. So raise your hand with a question, and I get to... So we'll start down here. And I would like to remind everybody to please phrase their question as a question so that that more people can have a chance to speak.
Hi,
to Dani.
Hi, Fanny. Welcome.
Thank you.
To Philadelphia. I've read all of your books and all of your memoirs, and this seemed the most Jewish to me. You had the most...
Says the rabbi.
You had the most citations and references. I would have expected that in devotion, because that was really phrased as a spiritual journey. And so I'm just wondering if the Jewish piece of you, how the Jewish piece of you reconciled with the fact that you then found out that your father was a Presbyterian person.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. It actually just made sense of me. And I think, if anything, made me understand the reasons for my having felt conflicted. not because I'm, you know, biologically half Presbyterian or whatever that could possibly mean, but because I had been, you know, Beth alluded to it briefly, I had been told every day of my life that I didn't look Jewish. I mean, it was just like boring. I felt like, really, that's, we're going to talk about that? Okay, we're going to talk about the fact that I'm the Orthodox Jewish girl that doesn't look Jewish again. But every day that would happen, and what, when that would happen, what I really felt was being, what I think unconsciously felt was being said to me is, you're not one of us. You're not one of us. And so I found myself, and I, you know, I've thought in the last couple of years of the many times that I would be in front of large Jewish audiences as a speaker. And there was some way in which I would be telling the story of my family and who they were and where they came from, and I would look out into the audience, and the expression kind of coming back at me a little bit was like, really? Like, that doesn't totally make sense. Because it wasn't just not looking Jewish, whatever that means. I did look like I came from someplace else. I look like my biological father, so I look like I come from Western Europe. I just do. And so I would be getting that all the time. And so it was confusing because I didn't know it and I didn't understand it. And so that sense of otherness that would come over me when I would be in shul or when I would be in a place that was, you know, largely Jewish, or when I would be with my cousins, my large clan of Orthodox Jewish cousins, and it was like, what's wrong with this picture? Well, knowing now what the truth is actually just liberates all that for me. And if anything, makes me feel more comfortable in my cultural identity. Yeah. I mean, some people think it means that, like, I'm going to go get a Christmas tree or something. I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it does explain certain things to me. I mean, this is an aside, but so that part of my ancestry, they actually, and you really, this also falls into the you can't make this stuff up department, pretty much came over on the Mayflower and settled parts of, you know, Massachusetts, seaside villages. And I've truly always felt incredibly at home in places like Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. And it's like, but I felt like at home, like I could live there. Why? You know, but these are real. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but it's real. There's like that sense of there was something I didn't understand. And it just, having it be understood is enormously liberating, and liberating in that way.
Danny, the first of your books that I read was Devotion, and I've loved you ever since.
Thank you.
The only one I have in Braille is Slow Motion, and I'm in awe of just how you move back and forth in time, and the book is in these pieces. I guess my two questions are, how did you come to that form in Slow Motion? Was it intuitive, or was it really a hard scrabble strategy? And like the second question is, do you have any advice for a writer who's basically a poet trying to write a memoir, and the biggest problem is figuring out how to handle the long prose form?
Mm. Dan is an outstanding writer, just so that you know.
I can tell from the question. So Dan, you were asking about Slow Motion and the structure of Slow Motion. So a couple of things happened. That was my first memoir, and I'd written three novels previously, which were, and I began Slow Motion with this sense that I could write it the same way as I had written my fiction, which turned out to not be the case at all. And I spent a year of, you know, in productive despair because I didn't know how to tell the story. And then there was a moment where I was with a friend of mine who's a journalist, and I was in despair and saying to her, I don't know how to write this book. And she said, well, have you outlined it? And as a fiction writer, that was a horrifying thought. Like, outline? No. And then she just looked at me. We were taking a walk on the beach, and I remember she stopped and she looked at me and she said, but you know what happened? And I was like, oh. So that's the difference between writing fiction and writing memoirs. When you're writing fiction, you really don't know what happens next. You maybe can see as far as your headlights, that famous Doctorow quote of like driving along a road at night, you can see as far as your headlights, but you can get all the way home that way. with memoir, you know what happens. So then the question becomes, well, then why tell the story? Right? So I went home after that beach walk, and I created a sort of an outline that looked like an arc. Literally, I drew an arc on a piece of paper. And I thought, well, this is what I know. I know that the book begins here at the moment that I receive a call that my parents were in a car accident. I know it ends here a year later when I go back to college after my father's death. And it fell into place with rapid, like I just understood it once I understood that I knew what happened, and that liberated me to create the arc of the story. But then if I know what happened, then why be alone in a room writing it? There's like nothing less interesting than sitting in a room writing what you already know. So what's the discovery? Or as my friend Andre Debuse, is a quote of his that I love, and I hope it won't offend anyone, but Andre says, you know, it's the difference between asking the question, what happened, and asking the question, what the fuck happened? Sorry, but it is. It's like, it's that question of like what's the deeper truth? And so I understood that beneath that arc hung everything that I didn't yet know, which was, how does this connect to that? How does this history, this childhood material, how does it inform the story that I'm writing, right? So that's like part one, two. That's how the structure evolved. Also, that was a book where I was in my early 30s writing about myself in my early 20s. So that 30-something-year-old who had survived to tell the story had to be a little bit present in the voice, had to be just present enough to be able to help to articulate some of what that 23-year-old couldn't have articulated. This phrase from an essay by Jane Anna Phillips comes to mind, which is intervening in the dynamics of loss. You know, the adult intervening, kind of coming in and kind of being a presence in the voice in some way. But then the second part of your question, I think, had to do with how to write long form when you've been a poet. A little bite at a time. You know, you don't have to think of it as long form as like, now I'm going to write 300 pages. Because if you're a poet and you think that way, you're going to become completely frozen. My work has become more and more fragmented. I don't know if you read my memoir, Hourglass, the one I wrote. So, I mean, the whole time I was writing that book, I thought, what is this? It's like a prose poem. What am I doing? There's no plot. And yet, it became a book that I wrote like one little bite at a time, and thinking of it that way and using the white space the way poets use white space.
Hi, in much of your writing, your mother, your relationship to your mother figures more than prominently. Did this experience in any way, I don't know what to say, shape your memory of her, your feeling, retrospective understanding of her, your current relationship to that memory and that understanding and so on?
Yeah, that's a great question too. This is like putting on 3D glasses. And, you know, a really interesting thing about being someone who's been a storyteller and who's been shaping her narrative publicly, you know, for a long time, and thinking about my life in stories, trying understanding my life and my family's life through, oh, so this is why this is the case, or that is why this is the case. One of the things that I realized is that all of that is still true. You know, my thoughts about why my mother was the way she was, why my father was the way he was, why they were together the way they were, they're all still true. They just weren't the whole truth. I was missing a huge, huge piece of the puzzle. I felt like calling every therapist I've ever been to and just saying, like, we were wrong. Like, we were just, the bone was over there. We missed the whole. But it was actually really interesting to realize that it wasn't not true. It wasn't suddenly all a lie. It was, you know, there was a piece that I just didn't know. And so with my mother, there's a moment in Inheritance where I write, it's a measure of maturity to be able to see your parents not as your parents, but as who they were before you. And I was forced to try to do that. And so I was forced to think of my mother as a desperate, frightened, traumatized woman who had, you know, already been through one marriage in which she had wanted to have children and didn't, married my father and was going to have a family with him, was so important to her to have children, and then to experience this infertility and to be 37, 38, 39 years old and just time completely running out. And also, I certainly wouldn't be here without my mother. I mean, we all wouldn't be here without our mothers, but I mean that in another way. My mother used to say to me, whenever she would get really angry with me, she would say, scream at me, I gave you life. She would say that. And I always found it, like, funny, sad, funny, kind of in that like, I can't believe you're saying that to me. But now that has other meaning. I mean, she actually really did. She even kind of masterminded me. In the sense that she found the place where this was going to work. She made it happen, whether my father was on board for it, which, given just in my research, I think he would have had to be, but whether he was or he wasn't, she went to Edmund Farris. She went to Penn. She made it happen. She spent her entire life, I think, pretty much deciding that it hadn't happened and that I was my father's daughter. She managed to do that. But yeah, I have a compassion for her that I've never had before. It doesn't change what our shared life together was, but it adds a dimension to it. It's like I had a palette of color and I was missing a few.
As somebody who has a family that's made of donor insemination, I've read the press for the book with, like, a little bit of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And I've wondered if it's felt re-traumatizing to you at all. Like, there's, like, an article in the Post that's like, Susie's not really related to Danny, or her real father and her not real father. And I guess I'm just wondering how it's all entering you after you've gotten some closure on the journey by writing the book.
Yeah, no, that's a great question too. I don't feel re-traumatized because I've just done so much work to be in a place where I was ready to go out in the world with this, but I'm very aware that the language that we use, it's more like, the feeling is more like, oh my God, really? Like, you're gonna, you know, and the pieces that you're referring to were more of the tabloidy sensationalized ones, which I just couldn't wait until they went off the newsstands. Like, let's have that go away. The serious reviews, I largely have not done that, and tend to be much more nuanced. But to me, what it does is just like a study of the way that all of this is understood and not understood in our culture. You know, that anybody would ever say real father or even father. You know, just the language around this needs an upgrade, and the understanding around it. So, it, like, in this moment in time that we're in, where these stories, so I mean, I have been thinking this and writing about it and saying it recently, but we're in a moment in time where all of these secrets are tumbling out. I mean, every single day, many of them, just a statistic, on Ancestry.com alone sold 7 million kits last year. It's the go-to Christmas gift and Hanukkah gift. It's the stocking stuffer. It's like the thing that everybody is giving their families on Christmas, hilariously. I mean, or tragically. It's very complicated. It's creating a lot of family drama. Out of those 7 million kits, the statistic is there is a 14% what's known as an NPE, and what that stands for is not parent expected. 14% of 7 million people on one DNA testing site alone last year. So if you're thinking about the sheer number of people who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s even, who are discovering that their parents, that their father, usually their father, although now also, you know, the egg donor kids are becoming of an age, they're discovering that their parentage wasn't what they had known, and there was this tremendous lack of disclosure, which has changed somewhat, not entirely. And in the heterosexual community, where it doesn't have to be disclosed, it's disclosed a whole lot less. I mean, and so all of that is happening, and that reckoning is happening right now. And so I feel like my book becomes a little bit of a lightning rod and a catalyst for maybe having a different kind of conversation. And I didn't want this story. I inherited it. I discovered it. I'm very glad I know it. But it also creates in me a sense of purpose, because I can give this voice and I can say, well, no, that's actually not language that makes sense here. And no, it's very important to me in every event that I do, in every bit of media that I do, to say, no, when I met him, he didn't feel like my father. No, my father is my father. But I had to go through that journey, but he's my dad. He loved me into being. And I'm very grateful that I was made by three people. It took a village, you know? And so that's just, and you know, it's a strange thing for all of us. Like there's, you know, that moment where Shirley says, you're not an accident of history. There's a moment later in the book where I think, we're all accidents of history. Because I was walking around really feeling for a while kind of a freak show. The language around all of this, especially earlier, was test tube tots and artificial bastards and these terrible, I mean, like the legality of it, it was considered adultery if a woman was donor inseminated. The husband could divorce her and not claim paternity and not. I mean, there were legal cases like this. So stunning stuff that I could really only look at a tiny little bit at a time. And that all has changed tremendously, but there's a long way to go.
I love that that was the final question, and I know that Danny's going to be signing books. Philadelphia, thank you for coming out to meet Danny tonight. And get your book signed.
Thanks, Beth. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.